radiotherapy is one of the biggest technology gaps in medicine today.
It's certainly been an issue that hasn't had a lot of attention to date.
Because of the civil war, everything was destroyed.
How can you train people if there's nothing in the country as yet?
Hello, and thank you for listening to part 2 of Global Access to Radiotherapy, The Silent Crisis. I'm Saif Ahmed, and in this podcast we are going to explore the potential solutions to the massive inequality in radiotherapy access in low and middle income countries. Also, if you haven't yet listened to part 1 of our podcast, I advise you do so first, but to recap, we heard about some of the statistics that define the scale of this problem, and that essentially lack of radiotherapy access worldwide leads to the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives each year. And that in fact investment in radiotherapy infrastructure could lead to savings of billions of dollars in the long term for these countries. We also learned about the inspiring work that has been done in Cambodia in order to fund and build a national cancer centre which opens in a few months' time. This podcast series is linked to the latest special issue in the RCR Clinical Oncology Journal, which contains an array of insightful articles discussing the full breadth of this issue. So how are we going to bridge the largest technology gap in healthcare today? Given that a number of Western countries have been first grappling with challenges in funding their own healthcare services, and second, been engaged in increasingly volatile debates around immigration and a sense of duty towards other countries, one might believe the answer to this question has never been more difficult. But in this podcast, we explore solutions that are much more attainable than what we may first think, and it will make us consider the precise role that more developed countries and healthcare institutions should play in tackling this problem, as a more collaborative and enabling approach means the issues I raised are far less prohibitive. We hear first from Dr. Daniel Rodin, who you'll remember from part 1 was a member of the Global Task Force for Radiotherapy and Cancer Control, GTFRCC, and is a radiation oncologist based in Toronto. Clearly, a health economics argument will underpin any policy decision surrounding radiotherapy services, and Daniel starts by telling us about the HERO project, which has examined the health economics of radiotherapy in European countries.
So HERO stands for Health Economics in Radiation Oncology, and the HERO project was launched in 2010 by the European Society for Radiotherapy and Oncology to generate knowledge and modeling tools for health economic evaluation of radiation treatments in Europe. And so to accomplish these goals, HERO evaluates the availability and accessibility of radiotherapy in Europe and compares this data to the demand for services. And it also looks at the cost of services across different settings. And this information can then be integrated into cost-effectiveness analyses to determine whether new and emerging technologies should be implemented on a wide scale. So this group is chaired by the current president of ESTRO, Dr. Yolanda Leivens from Belgium, and Dr. Kai Grau from Denmark. And analyses from this group are conducted across Europe, including several middle-income countries, as well as within specific countries to facilitate local capacity building. And so the HERO project is an important example of how a data-driven approach can be used to guide radiotherapy investment in different settings.
I then asked Danielle about HTAs, or health technology assessments, as from having read her article in Clinical Oncology, these were a key component of an economic evaluation.
HTA is simply a form of policy research that examines the consequences of using a healthcare technology over a defined period of time. So by integrating information on clinical effectiveness, efficiency, and economics, HTA helps decision makers answer important policy questions, such as whether a particular treatment should be reimbursed in a national healthcare system or for which patients it should be provided. And so this form of analysis leads to robust health policies that are patient-centered and that achieve the so-called best value for money.
And if you did this type of analysis for radiotherapy in low and middle-income countries, I appreciate it's probably different for different countries. What kind of findings do you tend to see?
A lot of local HTA has not actually yet been conducted on radiotherapy in low and middle-income countries, and that's really what we're advocating for in the article in this issue of Clinical Oncology. With the Global Task Force, we took a sort of HTA approach where we quantified the burden of disease and the demand for radiotherapy over the next 20 years, as well as facilities, equipment, and human resources that would be needed to meet that projected need and their associated cost. And so under the direction of Dr. Rifat Atun, the task force then utilized that information to create an investment model to evaluate the economic case for national investments in radiotherapy. But that analysis was conducted at the level of World Bank income groups. It wasn't actually conducted for an individual country. And certainly there are specific regional and local considerations that need to be integrated to make that kind of analysis more practical at the local level.
So who should be doing these HTAs?
It's a good question. And I think what we advocate for in this article is that it really needs to be done in country so that it can really integrate local needs and local values. But, you know, it's not enough to have an HTA process. This needs to be done to a high standard. And unfortunately, a lot of the HTA that's been analyzed out of some countries has not been up to sort of more international standards. And so it needs to be done locally and it needs to be done using the right tools.
Okay. And so do you advocate in these countries, is it something led by clinicians or is it more politicians and policymakers?
So some governments have health technology agencies, which are responsible for conducting a lot of these health technology assessments. They are intended to help inform the government and be directly applicable in the policymaking process. A lot of the information and data that supports those assessments does come from clinicians, and a lot of the outcome data needs to be generated in country by local clinicians as well.
Danielle also writes about the concept of value-based decision making, and I ask what that means.
I like the definition of value-based decision-making that's proposed by the economist Michael Porter, and he explains that value generally refers to the output achieved relative to the costs incurred. And in healthcare, value is defined as the patient health outcomes achieved per dollar spent. And so by integrating value into our health system, we can avoid a narrow focus on cost reduction that may eliminate some potentially very important health interventions that provide immense benefit for our population. And so in the paper, we discuss the importance of value-based decision-making for health systems in low- and middle-income countries, particularly with regard to interventions such as radiotherapy. And we explore the need for low- and middle-income countries themselves to engage in this sort of value-based research such that value is defined in a way that is meaningful locally. And there's a wide range of radiotherapy technology available, but each country has to weigh the added cost for small technological improvements relative to the value placed on efficiency, effectiveness, health-related quality of life, and other social and ethical frameworks.
We'll hear more from Danielle later. Now let's speak with Dr. Moramel, the radiation oncologist, who is an integral member of the National Cancer Center project in Cambodia. Given all of the challenges that we have previously discussed, it is particularly heartening to hear what has been achieved in that country. Here we describe the caliber of radiotherapy machines they will have at the hospital.
The first machine we're going to bring in is going to be Clinac IX with dual energy, 6 and 10 MV photon energy, which is recommended by IAEA, and with several electron energy as well. And the machine is supposed to be equipped with cone beam CT and with the capability of doing 2D, 3D, IMRT, IGRT. And also, when we have enough experience, we will move to the SABR and also the SOS as well.
This will allow highly sophisticated treatments to take place, and in fact, there will also be a full range of diagnostic, surgical, and medical oncology services. The hemato-oncology unit will have capability for bone marrow transplant. Of course, a lot of the more complex treatments require doctors to subspecialize so that they often only treat a small subset of cancers. But given that there will be relatively small numbers of doctors in Cambodia initially, I asked Maura whether this might be an issue and How subspecialized is the training he is receiving where he is right now in the Philippines?
Well, the setting right now in the training center we went to is not really quite different from our country. In the Philippines, the radiation oncologist is still like a generalist as well. I mean, they use radiation to treat all type of cancer. They are trying to subdivide the specialty in radiation oncology as well, but it will take a long time to do so because the problem is they don't have enough people yet.
Next, we speak with Professor Yolanda Levens, president of ESTRO and co-chair of the HERO project that Daniel told us about. She summarizes some of the issues we need to be thinking about if we are going to significantly improve global access to radiotherapy.
I think there are different issues. Well, there's one, people always think that radiotherapy is very costly, so we need a lot of money, and this is not completely untrue, because of course radiotherapy equipment is pretty expensive. But I think we should know that investing in radiotherapy really brings so many advantages for the cancer patients, and the investment as such is not so big. Actually, in our exercise, we, for example, tried to make an assumption of the cost per capita on annual basis in a region, how much it would be for radiotherapy. And if in Africa, for example, it would only be $0.50 per person living in Africa that would be required to have optimal radiotherapy coverage. So that doesn't seem to be an enormous amount. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think that we have to start investing in education and trying to find better ways in educating this enormous amount of human resources that we need.
Postgraduate training is something we cover in more detail with our next interviewee. Yolanda then mentions the importance of a conglomerate approach to cancer management, i.e. combining prevention, diagnostics, and a multidisciplinary approach to treatment. She then ends by highlighting the importance of thinking about the problem in the broadest possible terms.
In many countries where the resources are not very good, there's even more. We have to think about better distribution models for radiotherapy and cancer care as a whole. But we also have to think of how can we support the enabling services that support global oncology. Because, for example, you also need a readiness in your country to be able to produce radiotherapy. You need running water, you need cooling, you need electricity, for an example, if you want to make your radiotherapy sustainable. So I think there are really different levels in which we have to focus in terms of making radiotherapy available across the world. And obviously, we have to tailor this to the different regions. We have found in our article that it's very variable by region. But I really think that analysis on a country basis will be very important to try to understand the specificities, the needs in the first place, but also the possibilities in a country and try to tailor radiotherapy to that.
Now we hear from Dr. Jesper Grau Eriksen. He is an associate professor and radiation oncologist at Odense University, Denmark. Moreover, he works closely with ESTRO and has a particular interest in improving postgraduate education. I started by asking why postgraduate training is important in the context of radiotherapy in low and middle income countries.
Postgraduate training is important in worldwide. It's important in high-income countries, but it's also and especially important in low- and middle-income countries. You have to realize that around 57% of all new cancers occur in the low- and middle-income countries, but they only have access to around 5% of the world's radiotherapy resources, like bunkers and accelerators. So it means that the education is especially important in these countries also in order to use the resources the best way.
He went on to explain what the challenges are.
First of all, infrastructure is often less organized, and it can be quite difficult to actually get a grasp on how big this problem is. We have quite good knowledge about the need of accelerators, the need of bunkers, and what is actually present at the moment. But when it comes to the human resources in terms of radiation oncologists, medical physicists, and radiation technologists or RTTs, we do only have quite sparse data. Some countries have quite a good knowledge of their needs. Other countries, there is absolutely few data. But if we look into the available data at the moment, there seems to be a big challenge ahead of us. As you know, the world demography changes. We will have more elderly in the future. And actually, if we predict how things would be in 2020, there will be a need for radiotherapy for at least 60% of all cancer patients, and the big rise will be in the low and middle income countries. So it's actually estimated that we need at least 12,000 more radiation oncologists, around 10,000 more medical physicists, and almost 30,000 more RTTs in the low and middle income countries at the end of 2020. So we have an absolutely huge task ahead of us in educating medical staff and healthcare professionals for cancer treatment in the future. Secondly, we also need to be aware of that things are quite heterogeneous. When we just talk about low and middle income countries, we really need to be aware of that the situation is extremely heterogeneous. There are low and middle income countries with quite well-structured teaching facilities, whereas other countries have absolutely no local teaching facilities and training institutions. So it's one of the other major issues is that there's a lack of teaching infrastructure. And this is where the rest of the world and the high-income countries might have a way to help these countries. But we also need to know that there are quite differences between these countries, and therefore this should be done in collaboration with local specialists. So first of all, to create this is an extremely huge task, especially because there are really a lack of both training institutions and healthcare professionals. On top of that, training is especially difficult in these countries because it often means that they need to go abroad. Doctors or other healthcare professionals need to go abroad in order to be trained. That is seen in a broad perspective, both expensive, inefficient, and it also poses the risk of brain drain as people trained abroad for several years, they might be reluctant to come back to their home countries. The real challenge is a huge need and no infrastructure as it is today.
The point about brain drain is an important one. And I asked Mora about that too. Did he think there was a risk of trainees not coming back within the Cambodian National Cancer Center project?
No, I don't think so. Even though I can't say it's 0%, that it's not a risk, but I say less than 5% that we will encounter such a problem. Because the people we selected to join the teams are just few of us, and then we were very selective when we asked them to join the team. So we look at their commitment and look at their like willingness to go back, and also for formality, they all signed the contract to go and work for our project. But the contract is just a matter of formality to me. I mean, basically, we all want to do something because this is quite exciting somehow and promising as well. It is the first National Cancer Center project ever. And we are like the core team. We are supposed to go back and implement what we learned to use our competent skill to treat the cancer patient properly. And then we are supposed to set up our own training to make sure that we can grow all of this specialty back in the country as well.
Jesper now tells us about how we can approach postgraduate training in low and middle income countries.
This needs to be done in collaboration with the individual countries because they are the real experts in the local conditions. And I think that the big international societies have an obligation here also to try to collaborate with these countries in order to improve the postgraduate training. And there's a lot of good examples of this. ESTRO provides training outside their US and Europe. But also, and especially the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, provides the structure and the support for many of these countries. And this is one of the first steps to organize a collaboration between the big societies and the low and middle income countries. On top of that, we have to realize that since the year 2000, the internet access has increased worldwide. And today it's estimated that around one third of the African population actually have quite good internet access. In a country like Rwanda, for example, they have 4G internet across the country. The Asian population, around half of them have access to internet, and in Latin America, it's 2 out of 3 persons that have access. So the internet have a great opportunity for also sharing postgraduate education across the world. So internet opens for several possibilities to deliver a part of the postgraduate training using different online interactive classroom, wikis, discussions fora, decision apps. And this is one of the ways that we could really exchange the knowledge and education. And of course, this needs to be mixed with live training at local centers, but it could also reduce the teaching burden locally. And on top of that, making the postgraduate teaching international and available at all times of the day, even in local centers. So I see a great potential in using the internet for the future development of training for not just medical doctors, but also for other healthcare professionals within cancer treatment.
Jesper then went on to explain that there are a number of institutions worldwide, including in North America and Europe, that have set up successful exchange programs, and clearly that's something that needs to be built upon. The Clinical Oncology Special Issue includes a number of excellent articles from authors not featured in these podcasts. An article by Fien et al. Examines innovations in radiotherapy technology which can help bridge the gap in technology more efficiently. These include automatic treatment planning to reduce physics staff shortages, real-time image-guided adaptive radiotherapy technologies, fixed-beam radiotherapy treatment units that use the patient rather than gantry rotation to reduce infrastructure costs and staff-to-patient ratios, also cloud-based infrastructure programs which will facilitate international collaboration and quality assurance, as well as high-dose rate mobile cobalt brachytherapy techniques for intraoperative radiotherapy. Approaching the end of this podcast, we now hear again from Dr. Danielle Rodine and also Dr. Mei-Ling Yap, radiation oncologist at Sydney, Australia, who elaborate upon the ways we can go about improving global access to radiotherapy. Danielle starts by telling us what comes next following on from the Global Task Force's work.
The GTFRCC itself has closed, and it closed with the publication of the commission report in Lancet Oncology last year. But there's now an effort to create a GTFRCC 2.0, which is a commitment and a collaboration between ESTRO and other national and international societies to help achieve the goals of the GTFRCC. And I believe that the findings of the GTFRCC convincingly show the value of radiotherapy as a healthcare investment. We showed that radiotherapy not only saves millions of lives, but also brings positive economic benefits. And although there are large initial investment requirements, the longevity of radiotherapy equipment allows the cost to be amortized over time and the immense benefits to be realized. And so we showed that radiotherapy is feasible in LMICs and through case studies in the report, and we're seeing it on the ground now, if decisive action is taken. And in order to achieve the aim of universal access to radiotherapy, the global community has to work together to embed radiotherapy as a key element of national healthcare strategies. Investment in radiotherapy must be made part of a sustained investment in cancer care from diagnosis right through to survivorship. It's not an investment that's made in isolation. And so accomplishing that will require cohesive action by governments, by UN agencies, professional associations, industry, civil society, and grassroots networks. And there is a precedent for this type of commitment and global philanthropy. We've seen it in HIV/AIDS, we've seen it in maternal and child health, and we've seen it in vaccine-preventable diseases. We now have the power to see it for cancer and specifically for radiotherapy.
I ask Mei-Ling, where all the money required for this initial investment is going to come from?
So the good question. So that's really the sort of million-dollar question, or in this case, the multi-million or billion-dollar question. At present, I guess, a lot of the costs are falling on governments, and it may be the case that some governments may not yet be ready. So there are countries that are plagued by civil war and so on, and certainly we recognize that for those, some of those countries, they may not be ready. But in time, many countries, things can change quite quickly. So in the case of Cambodia, a country that I'm working with at the moment to try and help with the development of their cancer services, you know, they've, for many decades, expanding cancer services was not on the agenda in the fallout after their genocide and the regime then. But they now, you know, have made a lot of economic gains in the last decade and are now in the process of building a comprehensive cancer centre with radiotherapy. And an important issue to mention is that there's a difference between costs and price. And I think we certainly need to be able to work with the vendors of the radiotherapy machines to talk about pricing, because it may be that certainly in the case of, for example, HIV, there was a lot of work done with working with the pharma companies in terms of the price. And I think with radiotherapy machines, hopefully our friends in the main vendor companies may be able to come up with solutions for lower middle income countries. I recently came back from a meeting at CERN in Switzerland that's looking at the possibility of whether or not we can find a more low price sort of alternative for machines in low middle income countries. So we do have to get a bit more innovative in our approach.
Mei Ling also talks about the value of foreign aid and philanthropy, and that's something we might explore in more detail in a future podcast.
The case of, for example, the Australian government providing some support for some of our neighbouring countries to help develop cancer services, I think we certainly need to make a push for more of this. And then there's a potential role for philanthropy. For example, there is a volunteer and not-for-profit organisation called Radiating Hope, who raise money in a very interesting way by arranging mountain climbs, and the money that they make from the mountaineering expeditions goes towards funding machines in lower middle income countries, most recently a brachytherapy machine in Senegal.
She also reiterates the importance of increasing numbers of trained personnel in these areas. And although big numbers of staff are needed, one advantage lies in the fact that human resource costs are significantly less in these countries compared to higher income countries. The IAEA provides significant resources to aid training. However, they don't necessarily cover on-the-ground support. For the Cambodian National Cancer Centre project, that's something an organisation, APRASIG, has helped with.
I co-chair a group called APRASIG. It's an Asia-Pacific special interest group of our College of Radiation Oncologists here in Australia and New Zealand, so very similar to the Royal College of Radiologists in the UK. With the help of some Australian government funding, we'll be sending a few staff to work for hopefully about a year alongside our colleagues in Cambodia, so setting up their radiotherapy service to try to help develop a sustainable and safe radiotherapy service.
Danielle now shares a message to oncologists listening worldwide about how we should be engaging with this massive issue.
I think that it's very important as clinicians and as physicians that we think about patients beyond the four walls of our clinic. Cancer is a global problem, and I think we have a moral imperative as physicians to participate in that. And, you know, I mentioned before we saw it in HIV/AIDS. We saw physicians around the world alongside their patients advocating for greater access to care worldwide. And I think it's our responsibility now to take that stand for cancer patients worldwide to advocate for better services. You know, we have a lot of special knowledge and expertise, and it's very important that we help share that with governments and with policymakers and with other non-governmental organizations to help make this a priority. Because if it's not recognized as such, as a priority, we will not get the kind of global response that is really required to address this problem. There are lots of ways to get involved, and it's very helpful to connect with societies such as ESTRO, which is very engaged in that work. and engaging with other researchers. There are new organizations popping up for people within oncology, Medical Physics Without Borders, the International Cancer Expert Corps are just a couple of examples of organizations that are looking to engage with physicians and physicists and other health professionals around the world. And for the trainees, there's groups like Global RT and Radiating Hope, which are always looking to engage other radiotherapy professionals.
We talked about Global RT in part one of the podcast, and it's an excellent website that you can reach by going on globalrt.org. The final word comes from Maura, who tells us what he has learned from being part of the Cancer Center project. He acknowledges that international collaboration is vital in bringing about changes in low and middle income countries, but he points out that this change really has to come about from within that country, and that this is much more attainable than what people may think.
What I can say is we need the only a few people, the right people, who know how to plan the project really well. And then I believe the most important thing is to gather enough competent people or potential people to go out for training and come back, work together. I mean, with a proper plan or project, you can present it to the policymaker, and I'm sure that it will be convincing enough for them to put some fund in order to pursue, because finally, it's going to be for the sake of the people in the country, in Cambodia. Once we have all of those facilities, I believe that people don't have to go out and stay like for 6 to 8 weeks in another country where they don't even speak the language at all to get a cancer treatment such as a radiotherapy. So it's really promising.
Thanks for listening, and as before, if you have any comments, you can email us at clinicaloncology, and my Twitter handle is safeahmed_UK. There will be more Clinical Oncology podcasts throughout the year, so do subscribe to us so that you don't miss out. Finally, I'd like to thank all of the interviewees on this podcast, as well as everyone at the RCR and Elsevier who helped put this all together. Hopefully the silent crisis has become a little bit louder. Thank you and goodbye. Thank you.